Hi, it's great to have your company. I'm Simon Smart.
And I'm Justine Toe.
And you're listening to the first Life and Faith for 2014. And we look forward to bringing you this program each week this year. Well, this week we're going to be talking about the topic of forgiveness. Nelson Mandela's death late last year really brought up this topic. He's such a figurehead when it comes to this issue of forgiveness and reconciliation and the possibilities around that. And so we're going to delve into this a bit today, Justine. We want to look at two things: a recent film, The Railway Man, which you've seen, and also a story that came to us by way of the author Malcolm Gladwell. But let's think about The Railway Man first of all.
Well, I'd never been to the Highlands before.
It's very romantic. You're romantic?
He's a wonderful man. I've seen it. But he's a mess. I want to know what happened to Eric. I don't believe in this code of silence that you have.
War leaves a mark.
This is the BBC. Allied forces in Singapore have surrendered to the Japanese.
When we surrendered, the Jap said we weren't men. Real men would die of shame.
You have no honor.
You're here to help us.
To build a railway.
If you help, you will have a good war.
But we said no. We'll live to fight you. We'll live for revenge.
He's alive.
He's alive. And I know where he is.
He won't have a clue you're coming.
This is what you're going to do, isn't it?
I'm afraid the museum is closed.
I'm surprised you don't recognize me.
Lomax.
I am asking the questions you answer.
I did not expect you to be alive.
What happened in that room? What did they do to you?
Justine, you've seen this film. What's it about?
Okay, so Colin Firth plays the adult Eric Lomax. It's actually based on a real story that Eric Lomax wrote. He was serving in Singapore during World War II, and after it fell to the British, he and a bunch of his compatriots became enslaved by the Japanese, who wanted them to build the Thai-Burma Railway, which became known as the Death Railway.
Some terrible stories of the suffering of the prisoners of war.
It was pretty epic. I mean, like, this railway is like 400 kilometres long, you know, terrible conditions. They've got nothing but what they're wearing and just, you know, hand tools to do this thing. It's, and tropical conditions, so you can imagine malaria, dysentery, all this sort of stuff. And Eric, he builds a radio, and just to kind of receive news about the war. But once it gets discovered by the Japanese, he's actually taken prisoner, he's tortured, he's interrogated. And after the war, I mean, he survives this experience, but after the war, it really leaves its mark on him. And you can really see this manifesting in his late in life sort of romance with the Patty character, which is played by Nicole Kidman. And so she's like, what's happened to this man that I married? Because nothing really happened until the wedding night, when he's like a whole new side of him emerged because he's just so scarred by the experience. And then he eventually discovers that the Japanese interrogator, who actually becomes, I guess, the focus of his rage because he spoke English, obviously, and was translating for the military police. He discovers that this interpreter is still alive. And so he actually travels to confront him. So you can imagine what's on his brain, what's on his mind when he's going towards meeting the guy who's formerly held him captive and done such terrible things to him, or been part of that torturous experience for him.
Now, you've mentioned that forgiveness is obviously a key part of this, so without giving too much of the story away.
Oh, I have to give all of it away, sorry.
What do you think made this an attractive story to tell for the filmmakers?
I think it's because forgiveness is so counterintuitive to us, and especially you think of, you know, like this guy who's been in captivity, he's suffered waterboarding, you know, way before the CIA made that popular, you know. It's incredible to think that someone who has every single right to lash out at their former captors would actually turn around and say, you know what, I recognise that you've suffered as well. That's like extraordinary. And I think it's the kind of story that will stop us in our tracks, because it flies in the face of everything that we think that we might do and might be justified in doing in such a moment.
You could say that again. I mean, it's hard enough to forgive people who've hurt you in a very minor way, let alone something as kind of deliberate and horrendous as this. Mm. So does the story teach us things, or do we learn stuff about forgiveness through it?
Yeah, the film itself makes some great points that, you know, I mean, the thing is, there is quite a difference between the real story and what the film is telling us. But there is a scene in the film where you've got Eric Lomax's character and Nagase, the Japanese interrogator. And this is when Eric Lomax is confronting him, and he's basically, you know, establishing in very clear English, you know, what exactly happened. So it's like, no, the soldiers weren't killed, they were murdered, right? And so he really wants to call things as they are, so that he's not going to let this guy fudge his way through euphemisms out of what actually happened.
So it's not a case of just, well, let's just sweep it away or forgive and forget.
You've got to tell the truth. You've got to acknowledge what happened, which is quite funny because the real guy, the real Nagase, actually became quite a tireless campaigner for peace and reconciliation off his own bat. It's not as though he was just, you know, just living large and, you know, doing whatever until he got sprung by the real Eric Lomax. Another thing that the film really brings out is that it's really important for the perpetrator to recognise their own error. So they can't run away from it. They can't just brush it under the carpet or just dismiss it out of hand. As a condition of reconciliation is that the perpetrator actually acknowledges what they've done wrong and the cost that it's had to the person. So that's the condition of reconciliation. And we actually see this going on in their story. Strangely enough, you know, Lomax, the real Lomax and Nagase became friends. Can you imagine? And they stayed in contact until their deaths. I think I think Lomax died in 2011 and then Nagase the year after, or vice versa. And it's extraordinary, absolutely. And you see that through the kind of confrontation between the two men, that redemption is possible and that it actually sets the perpetrator free as much as it sets the victim free as well. Actually, the last words of Eric Lomax's biography really sum this up. He says, "Sometimes hate just has to stop." So it's just crazy because, you know, on one level, as I said, you know, forgiveness, it makes no sense because, you know, you'd expect someone to lash out. But on the other hand, it's the only thing that can actually stop the cycle of violence from just going on and on and on.
A lot of men went through something you can't imagine. You'd have to let us just cope with it.
My husband isn't coping. I love him, and I want him back.
Will you stand by him, whatever he does?
I have to try.
I have suffered much, but I know you have suffered too. And you mean everything to me. Sometime the hating has to stop.
Now, Simon, you've come across this article written by Malcolm Gladwell when he was speaking about his book, David and Goliath, Underdogs, Misfits, and the Art of Battling Giants. Can you tell us the story of Wilma and Cliff Dirksen?
It's an amazing story. It fits in with our topic today of forgiveness. This couple, their daughter, Candace, was murdered awfully 30 years previously. She was on her way home from school and someone grabbed her, and her body was found a week later, and she'd obviously gone through an awful time. And the story that Malcolm Gladwell says was really struck him. He couldn't get over it, couldn't get past this story, was that when he was investigating this, he looked up the fact that at the news conference, a reporter asked the couple, the parents, "How do you feel about whoever did this to Candace?" And their response is pretty astonishing. So the dad, Cliff, says, "Well, we would like to know who this person or persons are so we could share, hopefully, a love that seems to be missing in these people's lives." You know, astonishing sort of stuff from a father in that situation. Wilma, the wife, went on to say that our main concern was to find Candace and we found her. She went on, "I can't say at this point that I forgive this person, but you notice that the stress is on at this point." And she said, "We've all done something dreadful in our lives, or we've felt the urge to." And Gladwell read this and he thought, what sort of people are these? Are they kind of saints or what's going on there, and it caused him to investigate it a bit further.
Yeah, I can't imagine that people at the news conference were expecting quite that response. Just as you've been reading it, it just struck me that to say you're not quite ready to forgive is one thing, but to then go beyond that, as Wilma seemed to, and say, you know, we've all done something dreadful in our lives or have felt the urge to, that seems like another, it's like a step beyond, you know, it's completely different.
I've read some of these stories before and I find them almost impossible to get my head around, but they can teach us lots of things about this concept of forgiveness. I mean, Wilma and Cliff were people from a Mennonite Heritage Christian church who in this particular group had a history of persecution. And Gladwell points out a number of Christian groups who've had that sort of persecution who seem to be able to do this sort of thing really well. It seems to come naturally to them. So they're people who, he says, took Jesus' teaching on forgiveness really seriously. They actually really lived it out. And sort of they wanted to follow Jesus, and they expected, therefore, to try to live out what he told them to do. And Jesus is the one, of course, who tells us to love your enemies, pray for those who persecute you,
turn the other cheek,
yeah. keep on forgiving people. And so, you know, here's some people who tried to really live that out. Malcolm Gladwell mentions the fact that Wilma had told him that she'd wrestled with her anger and desire for retribution, and he puts that in to show that she wasn't just some sort of fruit loop who kind of had no sense of the tragedy and the dreadful crime that this was. He says they weren't superheroes or saints, just a very ordinary sort of person. But he says that it was something in their tradition and their faith that made it possible for them to do something that actually was heroic and saintly.
Well, in light of that, how about we listen to a clip from Miroslav Volf on forgiveness? And in this clip, he talks about how forgiveness is a process rather than a single act, and it's also not a quick one as well.
Right, and I think, if one reduces forgiveness to simple, to single act, one makes it at the same time more difficult and is more flippant about it than one ought to be. I think there's also kind of a lifetime of character preparation for forgiveness. And then when one forgives always partially, one forgives and then takes back, and one goes in a circle. And in a sense, it's living oneself into the forgiveness one has imagined and one has named as something valuable, as something conducive to human flourishing.
In light of what Malcolm Gladwell said about Wilma, that there's something in their tradition and faith that made it possible for them to do something heroic, you know, they're ordinary people, it seems to resonate with what Volf talks about in that clip. You know, he says that we are to live ourselves into forgiveness. So, you know, forgiveness and reconciliation, that might be your ultimate goal, and the living into it takes a progress. So it's not this instant sort of an easy fix.
Yeah, I like the way he describes that, because I think that is the reality. For many of us who find it really hard to forgive even small things might want to take encouragement from that, partly because these sorts of grand stories of forgiveness show us the healing power of forgiveness, and so it shows us that it's something worth pursuing. But also the fact that it's, as Volf always says, it's sort of hard-edged. It doesn't try to make this into just a sentimental thing. It's facing the reality, facing the crime, naming it as that, and then going into this process. He very much reminds us that it is a process of trying to forgive people, and that idea that sometimes you can be forgiving someone and you might have a bit of a setback in that, but over a lifetime possibly, there's this healing process of forgiveness. But everyone we've been talking about in this story, at least, would identify the power of the Christian story, that bigger story that they inhabit, as the thing that makes it possible for this to happen. And I have that sense too, that it's God's spirit required for these grand notions of forgiveness. And so this sort of radical love of the God who dies for his enemies presents a model and an inspiration, but also the means by which you might even attempt such a thing. And it's good to know that there's a kind of a sense of healing possibility in all of that. It's a good lesson for all of us, I reckon.
If you've been intrigued by Miroslav Volf's comments, then why don't you think about signing up for the Rethinking, a public faith conference where he'll be speaking. It's organised between the Centre for Public Christianity, where both Simon and I work, World Vision and Arrow Leadership. So for more information, you can go to www.rethinking.net.au.